This is Conducting Business, a podcast about the classical music business from WQXR.org. I'm Naomi Lewin. That's Mussorgsky's opera Boris Godunov. A new production just opened at the Mariinsky Theater in Vladimir Putin's hometown, St. Petersburg, Russia. It shocked audiences by drawing parallels between the title character, who was a ruthless 16th century czar, and Putin. This is a rare case of political protest finding its way into classical music. Normally, when we think of protest music, we think of folks like Pete Seeger or Bob Dylan. But can a symphony or an opera support political messages, and can they affect change? Where are the great political works in classical music? In a moment, we will put that question to an author who wrote about Leonard Bernstein's political challenges. But joining us first, David T. Little, a composer whose works include Soldier Songs and Sweet Light Crude, and Ken Smith, a music critic who writes for the Financial Times and MusicalAmerica.com and other outlets. Ken, you are in Hong Kong right now, but you just attended the new staging of Boris Godunov. How explicit were the references to Vladimir Putin's Russia?
Well, I have to say, I've read some of the criticism that's come out of Russia, and I was not attuned to a lot of stuff that was in there. There were visual subtexts and clearly a lot of images that were put there as little time bombs to go off as soon as people saw them, or maybe a little bit later in the show. Not being Russian, I was still able to pick up on a lot of them, I have to say. And it was an amazingly powerful modern production. First of all, a modern production. That doesn't happen very much with Boris Godunov. This is the closest thing I think Russia has to a national opera, and they treat it with the utmost historical respect.
So this was clearly a form of protest?
Absolutely. And it was very much geared toward sort of reconceiving, in a way, what the source material and the source figure of Mussorgsky's opera was with the realities of Russia today.
So the bottom line is, did it work? Did Graham Vick, the director, get his points across?
They obviously came through, you know, and the ultimate question, you know, is it true to Mussorgsky? But, you know, you have to also say, is it true to which Mussorgsky? And there were several versions of this opera that have floated around. Gergiev himself, and this, he was conducting the original version, which, of course, the Mariinsky rejected back when it was originally written in 1869. They held off until the revised version from 1872 and even 2 years later than that. And even then, a lot of the stuff that Mussorgsky wrote was not allowed, I mean, was censored in its own time for being a little bit too close to reality.
Well, you mentioned Valery Gergiev, who was conducting. He is fairly famous for having supported Vladimir Putin in the past. So what was he doing conducting this staging?
That is a very good question. And recently, I mean, I saw a documentary film not too long ago, maybe about a year and a half ago, called Russian Lessons, which very much treated him as a pawn of the Putin administration in a not very flattering light. Conversations I had subsequent to that, he really started, you know, personally distancing himself from that. And although he does sort of speak of Mr. Putin, and certainly they have a certain public relationship, as any two public figures do there, he's very much distancing him as a friend and colleague of the administration, shall we say.
Did you pick up any buzz in Russia about the involvement of Gergiev and what this might do for his career, against his career?
He really didn't have a lot to say about this, although it was very clear within the Mariinsky itself. In the program book, for example, they were not shy about saying exactly what this meant for them in terms of making a statement about the administration.
David.
And throughout this show, you know, they would stage scenes such as, you know, the chorus coming out as basically people dressed up, T-shirts, jeans, the public in grand protests being sort of held back and restrained by people dressed up in very clear black and gray camouflage, you know, Russian police attire.
Thanks a lot for all the description of that. I want to ask David now, as somebody who has written quite a few political works, what do you think can be accomplished with a production like this?
Well, what I find very interesting from all I've read about the staging of the work is that it really is taking a classic story and a classic tale of power and bringing it into a contemporary context and I think it can be effective. I think people often, in when talking about political music, especially, you know, you mentioned earlier that we tend to think of protest music as coming from folk music tradition, or we think of Pete Seeger as opposed to his father, Charles Seeger, who was a very active political composer in the 30s. People seem to think that it's, you know, the term preaching to the choir comes up a lot. But I think it often can have an impact if it is approached in the right way and is aimed at the right, you know, thinking more of addressing or reaching an individual.
Okay, I want to bring in our third guest now. Barry Seldes is a professor of political science at Rider University, and he wrote the book Leonard Bernstein, The Political Life of an American Musician. So, Barry, Leonard Bernstein struggled all through his career with how to incorporate political messages in his music. What were the challenges he faced?
Well, first of all, let me get back to the question of the choir, because I think in the
preaching,
idea,
to, the
preaching
choir.
To the choir, the whole question comes up, well, who is this choir? When Bernstein was getting started in the 1930s to compose music that would have a political impact, it was fundamental that he follow what the composer Roger Sessions had argued, that if one is going to compose an American opera for these times, it ought to capture the social forces that are operating in American society. And clearly Bernstein had, as an example, had Blitzstein's Cradle Will Rock, where each of the characters represented a social force. And the idea was then to spark audiences into understanding their condition. And what Blitzstein was doing, and Bernstein was watching this as well, of course, was to somehow or other capture the aspirations of people which had been basically mutterings or gestures, not fully organized. And music would organize them, would give them inspiration to achieve their aspirations. So Bernstein, following Blitzstein, and Copland for that matter, and others in the 1930s into the 40s, was seeking to find means to take people from a kind of, again, sense of fatalism into some kind of political action. That was the fundamental problem.
So did he ever write the political music that he wanted to write?
Well, later on he did. I think that he did bits and pieces of it, but he never got to compose the one great work he wanted to create. That was a problem that arose only in the 1970s and 80s. The real issue is what happened to him from the Blacklist era on. What happened was that once the Blacklist was on, he tempered his hopes of writing a more radical piece. Instead, he wrote pieces like The Age of Anxiety and Trouble in Tahiti, which spoke to kind of metaphysical problems of the human condition, the kind of thing which no longer is going to be politically dangerous. He finally wrote a politically powerful piece, his Codger Symphony, number 3, but that was at the time when Kennedy was now in power. Kennedy was a close friend of Bernstein's, vice versa, and therefore he felt at ease to be able to write this kind of stuff.
Ken, I want to ask you, we've just heard what the government had to say about political activity. Are big arts organizations cautious about political music, maybe because they're afraid of upsetting
their
patrons?
I have to say, you know, much of my life now professionally takes place in China, so I see an entirely different world, and sometimes you're not even aware of what's political until after it's out there. There's a lot there. I mean, people don't necessarily court being political, but that doesn't keep what they do from being so once it's in the public forum. The winds, particularly in China these days, blow very quickly and change directions. There was an opera not too long ago, I mean, within 6 months, based on the life of Sun Yat-sen, which seemed like a very safe topic. I mean, it was 100 years ago from someone who was basically the founding father of China. But it turns out that, you know, if you're in Taiwan or in the mainland or in America, if you think of Sun Yat-sen, you have three entirely different views of who this person was. And once you get into the details, they are quite severe. So this show, which tried to at least take a neutral stand and not delve into politics, became political because it was not political.
That was the one row opera.
It was. And it was one of those shows that just clearly would not work in Beijing, particularly it was scheduled to run during National Day. It would definitely not work during the time it was scheduled to run. It did, however, play in Hong Kong, and it's one of those situations that could possibly have been avoided, but going into it, you didn't know what to look for in advance.
Well, David, you have written political pieces. What sorts of reactions have you gotten to your political statements in music?
I mean, they vary, you know, person to person. And the way I've approached the political in my work has evolved over the years. I mean, certainly a work like Sweet Like Crude, which is really satirical. I mean, it's a love song to oil. And it really is coming out of a sort of Spiffian satirical tradition. But then a piece like Soldier Songs is really concerned with documentation and documentary. It interviews veterans of wars. It asks them to speak of their experience. And then it creates a narrative based on these interviews that hopefully exposes some of the things that we don't generally speak about in society and yet are very important to things like reintegration and PTSD and all of these very serious questions that aren't necessarily at the fore. I think a lot of the way composers interact with the political, and I think this is true for me definitely, really is related to the time in which they're living and the way that that time, I think, can receive a political idea.
Is it harder to get funding for political pieces than for non-political ones?
I think it depends on who's funding the project, who you're asking. I mean, I think some organizations may shy away from it, and I think it also depends on the particulars. I mean, there are a lot of different ways that a work can be political, and some are very aggressively alienating on purpose, and I think there are probably some presenters for whom that's exactly what they want, and others think particularly in classical music that's less desirable. And these pieces have had lives. I mean, Soldier Songs has had a number of productions. Ted Hearn's piece, Katrina Ballas, has had a number of performances. I mean, there are pieces that definitely have lives. So I think that would suggest that there is support for this kind of work.
Barry, I'd like to ask you about Leonard Bernstein's Mass, which he wrote in 1971 for the opening of the Kennedy Center. That piece caused a great controversy. What happened?
Well, yes. When Bernstein started to write it, he was commissioned by Jackie Kennedy to compose the piece that would inaugurate the new center. He set to work a little later on. He was always slow getting started. But apparently what happened was that word got out that he was going to be writing a radical piece. And that began to scare, among others, J. Edgar Hoover and, of course, Nixon, who was the president. The interesting point here is that Bernstein gets started indeed to write a radical piece. And what did he do? He went to the Danbury Penitentiary, where Daniel Berrigan, the priest who had been part of this demonstration.
Yeah, Catonsville 9.
Catonsville 9, exactly. Yeah. Thank you. Berrigan was locked up. Bernstein went to visit him, and Bernstein was getting all kinds of hints as to what to do, from, among others, the Sermon on the Lamb, I think it was called, something like that, the Sermon on the Run, which sermon had been written by Berrigan. When Berrigan was on the lam from the FBI, he would show up here or there and give this sermon, which was an enormously powerful statement. So Bernstein seemed to be writing a piece that would indeed be a very radical one. He'd been giving speeches against the military-industrial complex, so it looked like this was what Mass was going to be. And one more thing, word had gotten out that when Nixon would show up at the inaugural ceremony and performance of the piece.
Of the Kennedy Center.
That's right, and the piece was being performed. Somebody would yell out some horrific term aimed at Nixon. Nixon would be embarrassed. So his confidant told Nixon, don't show up, and Nixon didn't show up. It turned out to be nothing of the kind, and the piece turned out to be not at all radical. No one on the military-industrial complex side, defense secretaries, presidents, were named, were even hinted at. So the whole thing turned out to be very one-sided and a rather, in my estimation, politically speaking, a very weak piece. Maybe great musically, but the political message was very, very meek compared to what he apparently had intended to do and what the FBI thought he was going to do.
Ken, do you agree with that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting time, and we're also talking about two different things, you know, during the course of the conversation here. We're talking about pieces that were conceived as, in essence, political statements, and pieces that are reconceived by directors or conductors as political statements. And the results are quite different, and the audiences are quite different, but
there have been a lot of great musical works over time that have had political messages in their day, but then that message gets lost over time. I'm thinking of The Marriage of Figaro or any number of Verdi operas.
Now that you mentioned Mozart, I mean, one of the things that I found most interesting about China, interesting in the Chinese May We Live in Interesting Times sense of interesting, is that the magic flute was once banned in Shanghai for a political cause, because the party secretary looked at this and said, well, no, this show is about a secret underground movement, meaning the Freemasons. And this is banned in China. We cannot do this show. And so for them, that was the entire point of the show. There was nothing else about the show to consider. Now, that was in Shanghai. 3 months later, it was done in Beijing. No one raised any flags.
Barry?
Yeah, there's a whole other dimension to this business. I think of John Cage, for example, probably the most apolitical composer ever. But when you think about the people he influenced and the concatenation of art forms that he did influence, be it pop art, be it living theater, be it dance, et cetera, by the time we arrive just a few years later into the early 60s, suddenly all of this stuff which Cage had inspired becomes a lot of the radical art forms of the 60s, and which have, of course, tremendous implications. And it strikes me also that, in this regard, why it is that so many authoritarian dictators and the like will ban works which are otherwise very, very abstract, but they are transgressive. And I think that's the whole point here. When a piece of work becomes transgressive of orthodox form or content, even if it is abstract, that is when the authorities clamp down. That's a kind of political music, as it were, which is not intended necessarily to be political, but which still has an enormous power to influence.
It's interesting, Barry and Naomi both. I mean, hearing you talk about The Marriage of Figaro and Barry talking about Cage, I mean, I consider Cage to be incredibly political in a very fundamentally anarchist sort of way. And, I, you know, when I see The Marriage of Figaro or The Magic Flute, I mean, I definitely, and maybe this is just, you know, where I'm coming from, but I definitely am very aware of the political and subversive elements of it. And so maybe it's just a matter
but
of perspective.
But not in the same way, I'm sorry, but not, you're not aware in the same way probably as somebody in Mozart's day,
sure,
for whom,
sure.
I guess that's what I mean, is that
yeah,
your average
no,
audience
true.
Member going to The Marriage of Figaro goes, oh, isn't that pretty music?
Sure, sure. And one can definitely, you know, there, because it's great art, there are many levels to the work, and one can take what they feel from it. But, you know, I mean, I guess this gets back to the question of, you know, where the political elements are. I mean, is it in the aesthetic level? Is it in the notes, in a way? Or is it in the direction? As Ken said, you know, I mean, there are a lot of different ways work can engage in that realm.
Well, for instance, there is Va Pensiero, the chorus of Hebrew Slaves in Nabucco, which resonated so much with the Italians when Verdi wrote it. And last year, Riccardo Muti led an encore of Va Pensiero during a production of Nabucco in Rome and preceded it with a speech criticizing the government for cutting Italy's arts budget. So I guess there are political pieces that still resonate today.
Sure. And it's interesting. I mean, one of the dangers and one of the things that as a composer you have to consider is that, you know, a political regime can come in and co-opt your work for their purpose. I mean, you look at, you know, the Nazi regime using Beethoven, for example. I mean, this is not what was behind the work as it was being written. And, you know, Hans Eisler famously said, if politics are going to concern itself with art, then art had better concern itself with politics. And so there is a certain preemptive action that some composers feel they need to take to make sure, you know, if my work is so clearly political in this way, then it can't necessarily be political in a way that I don't intend it to be.
Do you think any composers today are writing the next Va Pensiero, something rousing like that? Or do you think, by and large, they're more interested in taking a documentary sort of approach like the Katrina ballads or Phil Klein's Zippo songs?
Yeah, Zippo song is another great example. I think it varies. I mean, I think there's also nothing. I mean, the idea of creating an anthem, I think one will write what one writes, and if something happens to become an anthem for, you know, then great. It's a little hard to anticipate that unless you're, you know, again, like Hans Weisler writing the East German national anthem or something. You know, and there are people whose focus is really on that. I mean, I'm here in Nova Scotia, music directing a performance of Frederick Jevski's Coming Together in Attica, which is very specifically tied to the Attica uprising in the 70s. So, you know, these works are getting performed. My ensemble, Newspeak, is playing Sweet Like Crude on the Bang in a Can Marathon in a couple weeks. I mean, so it's the works are out there. And again, maybe it gets back to the question of The Marriage of Figaro. Maybe these works are such that one can hear them and not necessarily get the political message. And maybe that's good and maybe it's bad. I don't know. I think that just is where we are right now.
Do Bernstein's political works get that much performance?
Well, Mass had a big revival. In fact, there's a big Bernstein revival going on these days, but I don't think that any of his works these days are seen as political.
Was he ever really successful at writing a big political piece, or were his biggest successes in politics in his activism?
Yeah, his activism, yes. I think maybe Songfest, in certain places in Songfest, Bernstein came through politically now at his best. The opening in which he quotes Frank O'Hara Let us now do something un-American. Everyone knew what un-American meant. There was a double entendre, because on the one hand, un-American seems to mean small poem. But on the other hand, everyone knew un-American meant un-American Activities Committee. So let us not do something un-American, clearly. Then, of course, he's got Afro-American, Hispanic, feminist works that are being performed in Songfest, which are clearly works in which anger is being displayed. And the work was, of course, commissioned for the bicentennial. And here Bernstein was writing a work which was very, very critical of a lot of American history. And, of course, the great song, of what, to what you said by Walt Whitman, the poem that Whitman had not included in Leaves of Grass, which may be, in my estimation anyway, Bernstein's most beautiful song, a plaintive cry on behalf of gay men who could not lead lives of love in public. That was, I think, to me, Bernstein's great moment. And he called these, that Songfest, originally Notes for an American Opera. From it was to be created that great opera, and that's what he died frustrated in 1990, never having written that piece.
David, some people might argue that political messages weaken a work of art and that great works should transcend time and place. What's your answer to that?
I think it depends on how it's approached. I think there are certainly works that one encounters that I think the politics make the work fail as art. You know, if you look at a composer like Cornelius Cardew, you know, after his sort of big Maoist conversion, I think the works are less interesting as art than maybe his works before that, even though he was always very politically engaged. But you take a work like Frederick Shevsky's The People United Will Never Be Defeated. I mean, that is, I think, you know, it's just a great piece of art because just of his mastery of technique, and it's just a masterpiece. And yet it has this very specific political subtext, uses quotation, quotes Eisler songs and Italian communist songs. I mean, it definitely has a position, you know, The People United Will Never Be Defeated with a song of the Allende regime. I mean, so it has to be great art. That's the sort of the bottom line for me.
Ken, you've just recently seen a couple of opera productions that were highly political. How do you compare the effect of that to the effect of actual political activism on the part of people like Bernstein's political activity, Rostropovich, Kurt Masur, leading the forces against the East German government? Do you think one or the other is a better form for creative artists?
Well, I don't know that it really is an either-or kind of question. I mean, certainly when you get to the level of a Rostropovich or a Gergiev today or a Bernstein, I mean, clearly you see people who are not shy about, you know, for the most part, taking whatever kind of public notoriety and acclaim that they have and using that in a way that furthers or helps what they believe and what they want to champion. In a situation like the Boris Godunov production that Gergiev just did, that was a very public statement that whatever he might have in terms of a personal connection to Putin and a professional connection to Putin, he was very much claiming a sphere of independence. I don't know that it's an either-or. I think it's part of a whole grand thing, and the life of the arts cannot be, you know, totally separated from the life of politics. I think they really all go together, and people have to choose priorities and be true to themselves.
Well, I guess that leaves the question of whether classical music can ever have the same political impact as pop music when you've got a short, catchy song like, "Come on, people, now let's get together," or "We Shall Overcome." Can classical music ever have that same effect?
My feeling is that if music is going to have that effect, by and large, it has to be transgressive in form. All of the avant-gardes of the 20th century were avant-gardes in terms of form, not content.
David?
One thing, Naomi, the question of the market really comes into play here. I know during when we first entered Iraq, the Beastie Boys put out the song World Gone Mad, which I think I heard on the radio once, you know, and then it kind of got scrubbed away. So in a way, it gets back to this question of being subversive. I mean, I think classical arts and the avant-garde and new music have an opportunity to be a little more subversive than things for which the purpose is generating revenue.
Well, thank you all for a very interesting discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, indeed.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Conducting Business. Our guests have been music critic Ken Smith, author and political science professor Barry Seldes, and composer David T. Little. Brian Wise is our producer, and Bill O'Neill was the engineer. I'm Naomi Lewin. Thanks for listening, and you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.